This is Audible.
Alex Ferguson, My Autobiography. Written by Sir Alex Ferguson. Read by James McPherson. With a preface read by Sir Alex Ferguson.
Nearly three decades before this moment, I had walked through that tunnel and onto that pitch for my first home game, feeling nervous and exposed. I'd waved to the Stretford end and been introduced from the centre circle as Manchester United's new manager. Now, I strode onto the same pitch, full of confidence, to say goodbye. The control I was able to exert over Manchester United was a privilege few managers would be lucky enough to know. However sure I felt of my abilities on the move south from Aberdeen in the autumn of 1986, there could have been no way of knowing it would turn out this well. After the farewell in May 2013, the pivotal moments filled my thoughts. Winning that FA Cup third-round tie against Nottingham Forest in January 1990, in which a Mark Robins goal sent us on our way to the final, when my job was supposedly on the line. Going through a whole month without winning a game, which gnawed away at my confidence. Without the FA Cup victory over Crystal Palace nearly 4 years after my arrival, grave doubts would have been raised about my suitability for the job. We will never know how close I was to being sacked, because the decision was never forced on the United board. But without that triumph at Wembley, the crowds would have shrivelled, disaffection might have swept the club. Bobby Charlton would have opposed any move to dismiss me. He knew the work I was doing, the ground we were making up on the youth development side, the graft I was putting in, the hours I spent reforming the football operation. The chairman, Martin Edwards, knew it too, and it reflects well on those two men that they had the courage to stick by me in those dark days. Martin would have received plenty of angry letters demanding that I be cast aside. Winning the 1990 FA Cup allowed us breathing space and deepened my sense that this was a wonderful club with which to win trophies. To win the FA Cup at Wembley made the good times roll. But on the morning after our victory, one newspaper declared, OK, you've proved you can win the FA Cup, now go back to Scotland. I never forgot that.
Introduction. Several years ago, I began gathering my thoughts for this book, making notes in the spare time my job allowed me. It was always my plan to assemble a story that people inside and outside the game would find interesting. So, although my retirement took the industry by surprise, this autobiography has been in my head for many years. It complements Managing My Life, an earlier volume, and therefore, while briefly reflecting on my youth in Glasgow and lifelong friends made in Aberdeen, it focuses on my magical years in Manchester. An avid reader myself, I was eager to write a book that explained some of the mysteries in my line of work. In a lifetime's journey in football, you will have dips, lows, defeats and disappointments. In my early years at Aberdeen and Manchester United, I decided right away that in order to build trust and loyalty with the players, I had to give it to them first. That is the starting point for the bond on which great institutions thrive. I was helped by my ability to observe. Some people walk into a room and don't notice anything. Use your eyes. It's all out there. I used this skill in my assessment of players' training habits, moods and behaviour patterns. Of course, I'll miss the banter of the dressing room and all my opponents in management, those wonderful characters of the old school who were the greats of the game when I came down to United in 1986. Ron Atkinson showed no bitterness after leaving the club and had nothing but praise for us. Jim Smith is a fantastic character and a good friend. His hospitality would keep you there all night. When I did get home, my shirt would be speckled with cigar ash. Big John Sillett, who managed Coventry City, was another great companion, and I can never forget the late John Lyle, who guided me through my early years and was so generous with his time. My first encounter with Bobby Robson was in 1981, when Aberdeen knocked out Ipswich in the UEFA Cup. Bobby came into our dressing room and shook every player's hand. Sheer class. and his valued friendship was never forgotten. He was a big loss to our lives. There were others of the old school who were survivors because they had a work ethic you had to admire. If I went to a reserve game, John Rudge and Lenny Lawrence would be there, along with one of the big personalities of the game whose Oldham teams brought a freshness that would never be replaced. I mean, Big Joe Royal. Oldham gave us some scary moments. Yes, I'll miss all that. Harry Redknapp and Tony Pulis are other great characters of my generation. I was blessed to have had a wonderful, loyal staff at United. Some of them worked for me for over 20 years. My PA, Lynn Laffin, has followed me into retirement and is still my PA in my new office. Les Kershaw, Dave Bushell, Tony Whelan and Paul McGuinness. Kath Phipps on reception, who also ran my after-match lounge at Old Trafford, has worked at United for over 40 years. Jim Ryan, who is now retired, my brother Martin, who scouted abroad for 17 years, a very difficult job, and Brian McClare. Norman Davis, what a man. A loyal friend who passed away a few years ago. His replacement as kit man, Albert Morgan, is also a big personality who never wavered in his loyalty. Our doctor, Steve McNally, our head physio, Rob Swire, and all his staff. Tony Strudwick and his energetic bunch of sports scientists. Our laundry girls, all the kitchen staff. The general office of John Alexander, Anne Wiley and all the girls. Jim Lawler and all his scouting staff. Eric Steele, goalkeeping coach. Simon Wells and Steve Brown of the video analysis team. Our ground staff, led by Joe Pemberton and Tony Sinclair. Our maintenance team, with Stuart Graham and Tony, all hard-working men. There are maybe one or two I've missed, but I'm sure they know. I respected them all. Assistants and coaches helped me greatly down the years. Archie Knox, a real ally to me in my early years. Brian Kidd, Nobby Stiles, Eric Harrison, a truly wonderful youth coach. Steve McLaren, a very innovative and energetic coach. Carlos Queiroz and Rennie Mullenstein, two magnificent coaches, and my assistant manager, Mick Phelan, a really shrewd, observant, true football man. The foundation of my longevity lies with Bobby Charlton and Martin Edwards. Their biggest gift to me was the time to build a football club rather than a football team. Their support was followed by the great bond I had with David Gill over the last decade. There was plenty of ground to cover in this book. I hope you enjoy retracing the steps with me. 1. Reflections. If I needed a result to epitomise what Manchester United were about, it came to me in game number 1,500. My last. West Bromwich Albion 5, Manchester United 5. Crazy, wonderful, entertaining, outrageous. If you were on your way to watch Manchester United, you were in for goals and drama. Your heart was in for a test. I could have no complaints about us throwing away a 5-2 lead against West Brom within 9 minutes. I still went through the motions of expressing my annoyance, but the players could see right through it. I told them, "Thanks, boys. Bloody great send-off you've given me." David Moyes had already been named as my successor. As we sat in the dressing room after the match, Ryan Giggs teased, "David Moyes has just resigned." Despite our defensive frailties that day, I was proud and relieved to be delivering this fine group of players and staff into David's care. My work was done. My family were there in the Regis Suite at West Brom's ground, and a new life stretched out before me. It was one of those days that unfold like a dream. West Brom handled it with real class and looked after me perfectly. Later, they sent me the team sheets signed by both sets of players. Most of my family were with me, 3 sons, 8 grandchildren, and 1 or 2 close friends. It was a joy to me to have them there, for us all to experience this final instalment together. Our family marched out as one. Descending the steps of the team bus outside West Brom's ground, my intention was to savour every moment. It was not hard for me to let go because I knew the time was right. The night before the game, the players let it be known that they wanted to make a presentation to mark my retirement. Their most special gift was a beautiful 1941 Rolex from the year I was born, with the time set at 3:03 p.m. The minute of my emergence into the world, in Glasgow, on the 31st of December, 1941. They also handed me a book of photographs encapsulating my time at United, with the grandchildren and family and the centre spread. Rio Ferdinand, a watch enthusiast, was behind the main gift idea. After the book and watch were handed over, and a round of applause spread round the room, I noticed a particular look on some of the players' faces. It was a moment some weren't sure how to handle, because they had always had me with them, some for 20 years. I could see a vacant expression that seemed to say, "What's it going to be like now?" Some had known no other manager but me. There was still one game to play, and I wanted it to be handled properly. We were 3-0 up within half an hour, but West Brom were in no mood to give me an easy send-off. John Sivabek scored the first United goal of my time in charge on the 22nd of November, 1986. The last was registered to Javier Hernandez on the 19th of May, 2013. At 5-2 to us, it could have finished 20-2 in our favour. At 5-5, we might have lost 20-5. Defensively, we were a shambles. West Brom scored 3 goals in 5 minutes, with Romelu Lukaku running up a hat-trick. Despite the late avalanche in our goal, it was all light-hearted in the dressing room. After the final whistle, we stayed on the pitch to wave to the United end. Giggsy pushed me forward, and all the players held back. I was alone in front of a mosaic of happy faces. Our fans spent the entire day singing and chanting and bouncing. I would love to have won 5-2. But in a way, 5-5 was a fitting sign-off. It was the first 5-5 draw in Premier League history, and the first of my career. One last slice of history in my final 90 minutes. Back in Manchester, a deluge of posts landed in my office. Real Madrid sent a beautiful gift, a solid silver replica of La Plaza de Cibeles, home to the fountain in Madrid where they celebrate league title wins, with a lovely letter from Florentino Perez, the Real president. Another present arrived from Ajax, and one from Edwin van der Sar. Lynn, my PA, worked her way through heaps of correspondence. For the home game against Swansea City, the previous weekend, my last at Old Trafford, I had no idea what to expect, beyond a guard of honour. But then, we were at the end of an intense week of telling family, friends, players and staff that I had chosen to move on to a new phase of my life. The seeds of my decision to step down had been planted in the winter of 2012. Around Christmas time, the thought became sharp and clear in my head. "I'm going to retire." "Why are you going to do that?" Cathy said. "Last season, losing the title in the last game." "I can't take another one like that," I told her. "I just hope we can win the league this time and reach the Champions League or FA Cup final. It'd be a great ending." Cathy, who had lost her sister Bridget in October and was struggling to come to terms with that bereavement, soon agreed it was the right course. Her take was that if I wanted to do other things with my life, I would still be young enough. Contractually, I was obliged to notify the club by the 31st of March if I was going to stand down that summer. By coincidence, David Gill had called me one Sunday in February and asked if he could come and see me at home. "A Sunday afternoon? I bet he's resigning as chief executive," I said. "Either that or you're getting sacked," Cathy said. David's news was that he would be standing down as chief executive at the end of the season. "Bloody hell, David," I said, and I told him that I had reached the same decision. In the days that followed, David rang to tell me to expect a call from the Glazers. When it came, I assured Joel Glazer that my decision had nothing to do with David relinquishing day-to-day control. My mind had been made up over Christmas, I told him. I explained the reasons. Cathy's sister dying in October had changed our lives. Cathy felt isolated. Joel understood. We agreed to meet in New York, where he tried to talk me out of retiring. I told him I appreciated the effort he was making and thanked him for his support. He expressed his gratitude for all my work. With no prospect of a change in my thinking, the discussion turned to who might replace me. There was a unanimous agreement. David Moyes was the man. David came over to the house to discuss his potential availability. It was important to the Glazers that there was no long period of speculation when my retirement became official. They wanted the new man in place within days. A lot of Scots have a dourness about them, a strong will. When they leave Scotland, it tends to be for one reason only, to be successful. Scots don't leave to escape the past. They move away to better themselves. You see it all over the world, in America and Canada especially. Leaving the homeland creates a certain resolution. It's not a mask. It's a determination to get things done. The Scottish dourness others talk about sometimes applied to me as well. The Scotsman abroad doesn't lack humour. David Moyes is not short of wit. In their jobs, though, the Scots are serious about their labours, an invaluable quality. People often said to me, I never see you smiling during a game. I would reply, I'm not there to smile. I'm there to win the match. David had some of these traits. I knew his family background. His father was a coach at Drumchapel, where I played as a lad. David Moyes Sr. They have a good family feel about them. I'm not saying that's the reason to hire someone, but you like to see good foundations in someone appointed to such high office. I left Drumchapel in 1957, when David Sr. would have been a young boy, so there was no direct crossover. But I knew their story. The Glazers liked David. Right away they were impressed by him. The first point they will have noticed is that he is a straight talker. It's a virtue to be straightforward about yourself. And to put one concern to bed, there is no way I would get in David's way. After 27 years as manager, why would I want to involve myself in the football side? This was my time to leave that part of my life behind. Equally, David would have no trouble embracing our traditions. He was a fine judge of talent and laid on some marvellous football at Everton when he was allowed to sign a higher class of player. I told myself I would have no regrets about retiring. That won't change. In your 70s, it's easy to go downhill fast, physically and mentally. But I was busy from the moment I stepped aside, taking on projects in America and beyond. There was no risk of me lapsing into idleness. I was looking for new challenges. One great difficulty in the days around the announcement was telling the staff at Carrington, our training ground. I particularly remember mentioning the changes in my life and Kathy's sister dying, and hearing a sympathetic, "Ah." Oh. That really broke through my barriers. I felt a real jab of sentiment. Rumours had begun circulating the day before the official statement. At that point, I had still to tell my brother Martin. It was a difficult process to manage, especially from the New York Stock Exchange point of view, so the partial leaking of the news compromised me in relation to some of the people I wanted to confide in. On the Wednesday morning, the 8th of May, I had all the football staff in the video analysis room, the main staff in the canteen, and the players in their dressing room. The moment I walked into the dressing room to tell the squad, we made the announcement via the club website. No mobile phones were allowed. I didn't want anyone communicating the news before I had been given the chance to tell everyone at the training ground. With the rumours, though, they knew something big was coming. I told the players, I hope I haven't let some of you down, because you may have joined thinking I would stay. We had told Robin Van Persie and Shinji Kagawa, for example, that I would not be retiring any time soon, which was correct at the point I said it. Things change, I continued. My wife's sister dying was one dramatic change. Also, I want to go out a winner, and I'm going out a winner. Shock could be seen in some of their faces. Go to the races today and enjoy it, I said. See you on Thursday. I had already given the players the Wednesday afternoon off to go to Chester, and everyone knew that. It was part of the plan. I didn't want people thinking the players were being heartless by attending Chester races on the day I brought the curtain down, which is why I made a point the week before of confirming they would go. Then I went upstairs to the football staff and told them. They all applauded. Glad to get rid of you, one or two remarked. Of the two main groups, the players were the more dumbstruck. Immediately in those circumstances, questions will have filled their minds. Will the new manager like me? Will I still be here next season? The coaches would be thinking, this could be the end for me. The time was approaching for me to retreat from the scene of all this announcing and explaining and gather my thoughts. I had decided in advance to go straight home because I knew there would be a seismic reaction in the media. I didn't want to be leaving Carrington through a swarm of press and flashing light. At home, I locked myself in. Jason, my lawyer, and Lynn sent texts simultaneously at the point the announcement was made. Lynn would have been sending texts consecutively for 15 minutes. Apparently 38 newspapers in the world carried the news in the front page, including the New York Times. There were 10 and 12-page supplements in the British papers. The range and depth of that coverage was flattering. I had my run-ins with the written press down the years, but I never held grudges. I know journalists are under a lot of pressure. They have to try to beat television, the internet, Facebook, Twitter, many things. And they may have an editor on top of them all the time. It's a hard industry. The coverage proved also that the media held no grudges against me, despite all our conflicts. They recognised the value of my career and what I had brought to press conferences. They even made a presentation. A cake with a hairdryer on top and a lovely bottle of wine. It was well received. For the Swansea game, the stadium announcer played Sinatra's My Way and Nat King Cole's Unforgettable. We won it the way we did so many of the 895 matches in which my teams prevailed, with a late goal in the 87th minute from Rio Ferdinand. My speech in the pitch was all off the cuff. I had no script. All I knew was that I was not going to praise any individual. It was not about the directors, the supporters, or the players. It was about Manchester United Football Club. I urged the crowd to get behind the next manager, David Moyes. "I'd like to remind you that we've had bad times here," I said over the PA. "The club stood by me. All my staff stood by me. The players stood by me. So your job now is to stand by our new manager. That is important." Had I not mentioned David, people might have asked, "How about that? I wonder whether Ferguson wanted Moyes." We needed to show our unconditional support for him. The club has to keep on winning. That was the wish that bound us all. I'm a director of the club. I want the success to go on as much as anyone. Now I can enjoy games the way Bobby Charlton has been able to since he retired. You see Bobby after a victory and his eyes are blazing. He's rubbing his hands. He loves it. I want that. I want to be able to attend European ties and tell people, "I'm proud of this team. This is a great club." In the event, I found myself picking out Paul Scholes. I knew he would hate it, but I couldn't stop myself. Paul was retiring as well. I also wished Darren Fletcher all the best in his recovery from a colonic illness, which few picked up on. At an airport a few days later, a guy walked up to me with an envelope saying, "I was going to post this to you." It was an article from an Irish paper arguing that I had left the club the way I had managed it, on my terms. "Typical Ferguson," the author wrote. I enjoyed that piece. That was how I saw my time in charge of United, and I was proud to see it described that way. As I slipped out of the picture, David brought in three of his own staff, Steve Round, Chris Woods and Jimmy Lumsden. He also added Ryan Giggs and Phil Neville, which meant that Rennie Mullenstein, Mick Phelan and Eric Steele lost their jobs. It was David's call. I told him that if he kept my staff I would be delighted, but it was not for me to interfere or prevent him bringing in his own assistants. Jimmy Lumsden had been with David a long time. I knew him from my Glasgow days. Jimmy was born about a mile from me, in the next district along from Govan. He's a good wee lad and a fine football man. It was just a disappointment that good men lost their jobs, which happens in football. But it was handled well. I told the three of them how sorry I was that they would not be staying. Mick, who was with me for 20 years, told me I had nothing to apologise for, and thanked me for all the great times we had shared together. As I looked back, I focused not only on the triumphs, but also the defeats. I lost 3 FA Cup finals to Everton, Arsenal and Chelsea. I lost League Cup finals to Sheffield Wednesday, Aston Villa and Liverpool. And 2 European Cup finals to Barcelona. That is part of the tapestry of Manchester United too. The recovery. I always kept in mind that it was not all victories and open-top parades. When we lost the FA Cup final to Everton in 1995, I said, "That's it. I'm making changes here." And we made them. We brought in the young players, the so-called class of 92. We couldn't hold them back any longer. They were a special group of lads. Losing football matches at Manchester United resonates with you. Mulling it over for a while and then carrying on in the same old way was never an option for me. When you lose a final, it affects you deeply, especially if you have 23 shots on goal and the opposition have two, or you end up losing a penalty shootout. My first thought was always, think quickly about what you should be doing. My mind went straight to the business of improvement and recovery. It was an asset for me to be able to make quick calculations, when it would have been easier just to be disheartened. Sometimes defeats are the best outcomes. To react to adversity is a quality. Even in your lowest periods, you're showing strength. There was a great saying, it's just another day in the history of Manchester United. In other words, fighting back was part of our existence. If you're lackadaisical about defeats, you can be sure there will be more to come. Often, we would drop 2 points in a game by the opposition equalising with the last kick of the ball and then go on a 6 or 7 game winning run. It was no coincidence. For the fan, there is a culture of going to work on the Monday assailed by emotion from the weekend's game. A guy wrote to me in January 2010 and said, "Can you please refund me the £41 I paid for my ticket on Sunday? You promised me entertainment. I did not get entertainment on Sunday. Can I have my £41 back?" That was a fan. My idea was to write back saying, "Can you please debit the £41 from my profit over the last 24 years? You win all these games against Juventus and Real Madrid, and someone asks for their money back after a slightly quiet Sunday. Is there any club in the world that can give you more heart-stopping moments than Manchester United?" In any set of programme notes, I might have warned the supporters, if we're losing 1-0 with 20 minutes to go, go home. Or you might end up being carried out. You could finish up in the Manchester Royal Infirmary. I hope no one will disagree when I say nobody was shortchanged. It was never dull. 2. Glasgow Roots. The motto of the Ferguson clan in Scotland is Dulcis ex asperis, or sweeter after difficulties. That optimism served me well through 39 years in football management. Over that time, from East Stirlingshire for 4 brief months in 1974 to Manchester United in 2013, I saw beyond adversity to the success on the other side. The act of controlling vast change year after year was sustained by a belief that we would prevail over any challenger. Years ago, I read an article about me that said, Alex Ferguson has done really well in his life despite coming from Govan. Spot the offending phrase. It's precisely because I started out in the shipbuilding district of Glasgow that I achieved what I did in football. Origin should never be a barrier to success. A modest start in life can be a help more than a hindrance. If you're examining successful people, look at their mother and father. Study what they did for clues about energy and motivation. A working-class background wasn't a barrier for many of my greatest players. On the contrary, often it was part of the reason they excelled. In my time in the dugout, I advanced from managing East Stirling players on £6 a week to selling Cristiano Ronaldo to Real Madrid for £80 million. My St Mirren squad were on £15 a week and were left to fend for themselves in the summer because they were part-time. The maximum any Aberdeen first-team player earned in my 8 years at Pittodrie was £200 a week, the ceiling set by Dick Donald, my chairman. So the financial journey for the thousands of men I managed in nearly 4 decades was from £6 a week to £6 million a year. I have a letter on file from a chap who said that in 1959 to 1960, he worked in the dry docks in Govan and used to visit a particular pub. He remembers a young agitator coming into this establishment with a collecting tin for the apprentices' strike fund and delivering a firebrand speech. The only thing he knew about this boy was that he had played for St Johnstone. His letter ended with a question. Was that you? At first I had no recollection of this visit to the political arena, but the note jogged my memory and eventually I recalled going round the pubs in our area to raise money for the strike. I was not auditioning for a role in politics. To call my shouting a speech would embellish it with oratorical qualities it almost certainly lacked. I remember ranting on like an idiot after being asked to justify my request for money. Everyone would have been nicely lubricated and in the mood to hear the young fundraiser explain the cause he was advancing. Pubs were a large part of my early experiences. My earliest business idea was to use my modest income to enter the licensed trade as security for the future. My first establishment was at the junction of Govan Road and Paisley Road West, and was populated by dockers. Pubs taught me about people, their dreams and frustrations, in a way that complemented my efforts to understand the football trade, though I was not to know that at the time. In one of my pubs, for example, we had a Wembley Club, into which customers would pay for 2 years so they could get to the England v Scotland match at Wembley. I would double whatever was in the kitty, and off they would go to London for 4 or 5 days. Or, that was a theory. I would join them on the day of the game itself. My best mate, Billy, would head off to Wembley on the Thursday and come back 7 days later. Inevitably, this unscheduled extension of the trip would cause ructions with his family. One Thursday, after a Saturday game at Wembley, I was at home when the phone rang. It was Anna, Billy's wife.
"Cathy, go ask Alex where Billy is,"
Anna said. I pleaded ignorance. Maybe 40 of our customers would make the trip to the Twin Towers, and I had no way of knowing why Billy was absent without leave. But for the working men of my generation, a big football match was a sacred pilgrimage, and they loved the camaraderie as much as the game. The pub we had on Main Street, Brigton, was in one of Glasgow's biggest Protestant districts. The Saturday before the Orange Walk, Big Tam the postman would approach me to say,
"Alex, the boys are asking what time you're opening next Saturday morning, for the walk. We're going down to Drossan, which is on the west coast of Scotland. The buses leave at 10 o'clock, says Tam. All the pubs are open. You'll need to open.
I was flummoxed.
Well, what time should it open? Tam says. 7.
So there I was at 6:15 a.m. with my dad and my brother Martin and a wee Italian barman we employed. We're well equipped, because Tam has told me.
Get stocked up. You'll need plenty of drinking.
I open at 7 a.m. The pub is soon full of orangemen and full voice, and the police are walking by, not saying a word. Between 7 a.m. and 9:30, I took 4 grand. Double vodkas, the lot. My dad sat shaking his head. By 9:30, we were hard at work getting the place ready for the rest of our clientele. Scrubbed the place we did. But there was 4 grand in the till. Running pubs was hard work. By 1978, I was ready to escape the onerous responsibilities that came with running 2 watering holes. Managing Aberdeen left no time for wrestling with drinkers or staying on top of the books. But what good stories those years left in my memory. You could write a book just about those. They would come in on Saturday morning, the dockers, with their wives, having been paid on the Friday night, and deposited the money with me behind the bar in the night safe. On a Friday night, you felt like a millionaire. You didn't know whether the cash in the safe or the till was yours or theirs. In the early days, Cathy would count it on the carpet. On the Saturday morning, the money would be away again when these men came to collect it. The record of these transactions was called the tick book. A female regular by the name of Nan was especially vigilant in tracking the movements of her husband's money. She had a tongue like a docker. "Do you think we're all daft?" she would say, fixing me in her sights.
"What?"
I said, buying time.
"Do you think we're all daft? That tick book, I want to see it."
"Oh, you can't see the tick book," I said, improvising. "It's sacrosanct. The taxman wouldn't let you do that. The taxman examines it every week. You can't see that." Nan turns to her man, subdued now, and says,
"Is that right?"
I'm not sure," says our man. The storm had passed.
"If I find out my man's name's in there, I'm never coming back," Nan says.
These are lasting memories of a young life spent around people of great character and resilience. Tough people too. Sometimes I would come home with a split head or black eyes. That was pub life. When it became too exuberant or fights broke out, it was necessary to jump in to restore order. You would try to separate the protagonists, but often take one in the chin. Yet I look back and think what a great life it was. The characters, the comedy. I always remember a man called Jimmy Westwater coming in, unable to breathe. Grey was.
Christ, are you all right? I asked.
Jimmy had wrapped himself in Shantung silk to creep out of the docks without being caught. A whole bale of Shantung silk, but he'd wrapped himself so tightly in it, he could hardly draw breath. Another Jimmy who I employed, and who kept the place immaculate, turned up one night in a bow tie. One of my regulars was incredulous.
A bow tie? And govan? You must be joking.
One Friday night I came back to find someone selling bags of birdseed by the bar. In that part of Glasgow everyone kept pigeons.
What's this? I asked.
Birdseed, like it was the most obvious answer in the world. An Irish lad called Martin Corrigan prided himself in his ability to meet any domestic need. Crockery, a canteen of cutlery, a fridge, anything you like. Another guy walked in and announced,
"You want a pair of binoculars? I'm skint."
Out came a beautiful pair of binoculars wrapped in greaseproof paper.
"A fiver," he says.
"One condition," I said. "A fiver as long as you drink in here. Don't go over to Baxter's."
He was a nice guy with a speech impediment. So I get the binoculars, and he immediately spends £3 across the bar. When I brought purchases home, Cathy would go crackers. I can remember coming back with a nice Italian vase that Cathy later saw in a shop for £10. The problem was I had paid £25 for hours over the bar. One day I swaggered in with a new suede jacket that really looked the part.
"How much?" says Cathy.
£7, I say, beaming. So I hang it up. 2 weeks later, we're going to our sister's for a wee party. On goes the jacket, and I'm standing in front of the mirror admiring the cut. You know how a man gives the two sleeves a tug to get it to sit just right? That's what I did, and the two sleeves came right off in my hands. There I stood, with a sleeveless jacket. Cathy was rolling about while I was shouting, "I'll kill him!" There wasn't even a lining in the jacket. On a wall in my snooker room hangs a picture of Bill, my best mate. He was some lad, Billy. Couldn't even make a cup of tea. Back at the house one day after we'd been out for a meal, I told him, "Get the kettle on." Off he went, but Billy was gone about 15 minutes. Where the hell was he? He was on the phone to Anna, his wife, asking, "What do you do with the tea?" Anna left a steak pie in the oven one night while Billy watched the movie The Towering Inferno. Anna came back 2 hours later to find smoke spewing from the kitchen.
"Christ! Did you not turn the oven off? Look at the smoke," she puffed.
I thought it was coming from the telly," Billy cried.
He thought it was a special effect from the burning tower. Everyone congregated at Billy's house. They were moths to his light. He wasn't known as Billy, though. Everyone called him McKechnie. His two boys, Stephen and Darren, are a credit to him, and Anna. And are still very close with my sons. Billy is no longer with us, but I still remember him for all the fun we shared. I have a hard core of friends from that time. Duncan Peterson, Tommy Hendry, and Jim McMillan were at nursery with me from 4 years of age. Duncan was a plumber who worked for ICI at Grangemouth and retired very early. He has a nice wee place in Clearwater, Florida, and they like to travel. Tommy, who had some heart trouble, was an engineer, as was Jim. A fourth one, Angus Shaw, is looking after his ill wife. John Grant, who I'm also very close to, moved to South Africa in the 1960s. His wife and daughter run a wholesale business. When I left Harmony Row as a lad, it created a big division between me and the Govan boys. They thought I was wrong to leave the team and go to Drumchapel Amateurs. Mick McGowan, who ran Harmony Row, never spoke to me again. He was intransigent. Mick One-Eyed McGowan. He was an incredible enthusiast for Harmony Row, and just blanked me when I left. But the Govan boys and I would still go dancing up to the age of 19 or 20. We all started with girlfriends around that time. Then came the separation between us. The drift. I married Cathy and moved up to Sims Hill. They all married too. The friendship seemed to fall apart. Contact was intermittent. John and Duncan had played with me at Queen's Park between 1958 and 1960. In management, you have little time for anything beyond the demands of the job. At St. Mirren, I certainly didn't. But our bonds were not completely severed. About 2 months before I left Aberdeen in 1986, Duncan phoned and said it was his 25th wedding anniversary in October. Would Cathy and I like to come? I told him we would love to. It was a turning point in my life.
All the lads were there and it brought us back together. Our families were established. We were mature men. I moved to United the following month and we've remained close ever since. When you get to that age, around 19 to 20, there is a gentle parting of the ways, but they all kept together. It was only me who had a different type of life. It was not avoidance in any way, it was just the way my life unfolded. I was running two pubs and was manager of St. Mirren. Then came the Aberdeen job in 1978. Those friendships sustained me at Manchester United. They would all come to our house in Cheshire for a buffet and a sing-song, and we'd put all the old records on. They were all good singers. By the time my turn came, the wine would have infused me with an exaggerated sense of my own crooning abilities. It would be neck and neck between me and Frank Sinatra. There would be no doubt in my mind that I could treat my audience to a fine rendition of Moon River. Two words in, I would open my eyes to find the room empty. "You come and eat my food, and there you are watching telly in the next room while I'm singing," I would complain. "We're no listening to that. That's crap," came the reply. They are good, solid people. Most have been married over 40 years. God, they give me stick. They pummel me. They get away with it because they're so like me. They are the same stock. They grew up with me, but they were also supportive. When they came down, we tended to win. But if we lost a game, they might say sympathetically, "That was hard work." Not "that was rubbish," but "that was hard work." My friends in Aberdeen remain close. The thing I learned about Scotland is that the further north you go, the quieter people are. They take longer to forge friendships, but when they do, those ties run deep. Gordon Campbell goes on holiday with us, my lawyer, Les Delgarno, Alan McRae, George Ramsay, Gordon Hutchin. As I became more entrenched in the job at United, my social life diminished. I stopped going out on a Saturday night. The football was exhausting for me. Getting away from the ground after a 3 p.m. kick-off, I wouldn't return home until 8:45. That was the price of success. 76,000 people all going home at the same time. The urge to go out weakened, but I developed some strong friendships. Ahmet Kurser, the manager of the Alderley Edge Hotel. Satirius, Mimo, Marius, Tim, Ron Wood, Peter Dunn, Pat Murphy and Pete Morgan, Jed Mason, the wonderful Harold Riley, and my staff, of course, who were loyal to me. James Mortimer and Willie Hawhey were two old pals from my hometown. And there was Martin O'Connor and Charlie Stilettano in New York, and Eckhard Krautzen in Germany, all good people. When we did summon up the energy, we had good nights out. In my early years in Manchester, I grew friendly with Mel Machin, who was manager of City, and who was fired not long after they beat us 5-1. The reason given, I seem to recall, was that Mel didn't smile enough. I would have been sacked a long time ago had that logic applied at United. John Lyle, the manager of West Ham, was a rock to me in those days. I didn't know all the players in England and wasn't sure of the scouting department at United. I would phone John often and he would send me reports on players to supplement my own. I could trust him and confided in him a lot. As a way of telling me United weren't playing well, he would say, "I don't see Alex Ferguson in that team." Jock Wallace, the fiery former Rangers manager, also said to me in a hotel one night, "I don't see Alex Ferguson in that team. You'd better get Alex Ferguson back in there." Those men volunteered their advice, knowing that friendship was at the base of their observations. I call those the best friendships. Bobby Robson was manager of England, so that was a different relationship at first. But we too became close. Lenny Lawrence was another friend from that time, and still is. Bobby Robson and I re-established close contact at Eusebio's testimonial in Portugal when he was coaching there with Porto and Sporting Lisbon. Eric Cantona made his debut in that game. Bobby came to our hotel, and I will always remember him seeking out Steve Bruce to say, "Steve, I made a mistake with you. I should have given you an England cap, and I want to apologise for that." In front of all the players. So much of what I knew at the end of my career I learned in those early days, sometimes without realising the lessons were sinking in. I learned about human nature long before I headed south to United. Other people don't see the game or the world the way you do. and sometimes you have to adjust to that reality. Davy Campbell was a player I had at St Mirren. He could run like a deer but couldn't trap a rabbit. I was into him at half-time when the door opened to reveal his father.
"Davy, you're doing brilliant, son. Well done," the dad announced, then disappeared.
We were at Cowdenbeath one day with East Stirling and made the mistake of not checking the weather. The pitch was brick hard. So we went into Cowdenbeath to buy 12 pairs of baseball boots. We had no rubber soles in those days. We were down 3-0 at half-time. In the second half, I feel a tap on my shoulder from Billy Renton, a former teammate of mine. He says, "Alex, I just want to introduce you to my son." I say, "For God's sake, Billy, we're getting beat 3-0. That same day, Frank Connor, a lovely man with a hellish temper, watched a decision go against him and threw the bench on the pitch. I said, "Bloody hell, Frank, you're winning 3-0.
"It's a disgrace, that,"
Frank fired back. These were the passions swirling all around me. A story comes back to me of Jock Steen and his battles with Jimmy Johnson, the brilliant player and legendary Krauser. One afternoon, Jock took Jimmy off in a game as punishment for Jimmy not wanting to play in a European away game. As Jimmy came off, he said, "You big one-legged bastard, you," and took a kick at the dugout. Jimmy runs up the tunnel and big Jock gets after him. Jimmy locks himself in the dressing room.
"Open that door,"
shouts Jock. "No, you'll hurt me," replies Jimmy.
"Open that door," repeats Jock. "I warn you."
Jimmy opens the door and jumps straight into the bath, which is red hot. Jock shouts,
"Come out of there."
"No, I'm not coming out,"
says Jimmy. Outside on the pitch, the game is still going on. Football management is a never-ending sequence of challenges. So much of it is a study in the frailty of human beings. There was an occasion when a number of Scotland players, after a night of liquid entertainment, decided to jump in rowing boats. This ended with Jimmy Johnson, wee Jinky, having the oars taken off him and the tide taking him out while he was singing away. When the information got back to Celtic Park, Jock Steen was informed that Jinky had been rescued by the Coast Guard from a rowing boat in the Firth of Clyde. Jock joked,
"Could he no have drowned? We'd have given him a testimonial. We'd have looked after Agnes, and I would still have my hair."
Jock was hilarious. In our time together with Scotland, I recall us beating England 1-0 at Wembley in May 1985, and then flying out to Reykjavik to face Iceland, where we were feeling pretty pleased with ourselves. On the night of our arrival, the staff sat down to a banquet of prawns, salmon and caviar. Big Jock never drank, but I leaned on him to take one glass of white in celebration of our victory over the English. In the game against Iceland, we scraped a 1-0 win. The performance was a disaster, and afterwards Big Jock turned to me and said,
"See that? That's you and your white wine."
Despite having all this experience to draw on, I felt my way in the early years at Manchester United. Having a quick temper helped, because if I lost my rag, my personality came through. Ryan Giggs has a temper, but a slow one. Mine was a useful tool. I just weighed right in. It helped me to assert my authority. It told the players and staff I was not to be messed about. There are always people who want to take you on, defy you. When I started, even in my first days at East Stirling, I had a defining confrontation with the centre forward, who was the son-in-law of one of the directors, Bob Shaw. I was informed by one of my players, Jim Meakin, that his whole family went away for a weekend in September. It was a tradition.
"What do you mean?" I said.
"You know, I'll not be playing on Saturday," Jim says.
"Well, I'll tell you what," I said.
"Don't play on Saturday,
and then don't bother coming back."
So he played, and straight after drove down to join his family in Blackpool. On the Monday, I receive a phone call.
"Boss, I've broken down."
In Carlisle, I think it was. He must have thought I was stupid. Quick as a flash, I said,
"I can't hear you very well. Give me your number, I'll call you back."
Silence.
"Don't come back," I said.
Bob Shaw, the director, was deeply unhappy with me. This went on for weeks and weeks. The chairman was saying, "Alex, please, get Bob Shaw off my back. Get Jim back playing." I said,
"No, Willie. He's finished."
"Are you telling me I can do my job with guys deciding when they're going to go on holiday?"
I understand the problem, but
Is 3 weeks not enough? He said. The next week, he followed me into the toilets at Forfar, stood beside me and groaned. Please, Alex, if there's any Christian understanding in your body. After a pause, I said,
All right.
And he kissed me. What are you doing, you silly old sod? I said. You're kissing me in a public toilet. In October 1974, in the next stage of my apprenticeship, I went to work for St Mirren. First day, a photograph in the Paisley Express. In the print, I noticed the captain making a gesture behind my back. The following Monday, I called him in and said, You've got a free transfer if you want it. There's no place for you here. You'll not be playing. Why? He says. For a start, doing a V-sign behind a manager doesn't tell me you're an experienced player or that you're a mature person. I'm looking for a captain. I'm looking for maturity. That was a childish schoolboy trick. You have to go. You have to make your mark. As Big Jock said to me about players, never fall in love with them, because they'll two-time you. At Aberdeen, I had to deal with all sorts of transgressions. I caught plenty out. Afterwards, you kill yourself laughing at the reactions. Me, they would say, with the most brilliantly wounded expression. I, you. Oh, I went to see a mate. Oh, did you? For 3 hours, and ended up pissed. Mark McGee and Joe Harper would test me plenty. Then there was Frank McGarvey at St Mirren. One Sunday in 1977, we took 15,000 fans to a cup game at Fir Park, but lost 2-1. Motherwell kicked us off the park, and I was reported to the SFA for saying the referee had not been strong enough. That Sunday night, my home phone rang. My mate John Donaghy said down the line,
I didn't want to tell you before the game because I knew you would go off your head, but I saw McGarvey in the pub pissed on Friday night.
I phoned his house. His mother answered, Is Frank in?
No,
she said.
He's in town. Is there anything I can help you with?
Can you ask him to phone me when he comes in? I'll stay up. I'm not going to bed until I've spoken to him. At 11:45 p.m, the phone went. Pips sounded, so I knew it was a payphone.
In the house,
Frank said. But that's Pips, I said.
Yeah, we've got a payphone in our house,
says Frank. That much was true, but I didn't believe he was ringing from there. Where were you on Friday night?
I can't remember,
he says. Well, I'll tell you. You were in the Waterloo Bar. That's where you were. You're suspended for life. Don't come back. You're out of the Scotland under-21s. I'm withdrawing you. You'll never kick another ball in your life. And I put the phone down. The next morning, his mother rang me.
My Frank doesn't drink. You've got the wrong man.
I told her. I don't think so. I know every mother thinks the sun shines out of their son's backside, but you go back and ask him again. For 3 weeks, I had him suspended for life, and the players were all muttering about it. A league decider against Clydebank was approaching, and I told my assistant, Big Davy Proven, I need him back for this one. The club do was at the town hall in Paisley the week before the Clydebank game. I walked in there with Cathy, and suddenly Frank jumped out from behind one of the pillars, begging, Just give me one more chance. This was a gift from heaven. There was me wondering how I could bring him back into the fold without losing face, and he jumps out from behind a pillar. I told Cathy to walk in while I maintained my sternest tone with Frank. I told you. You're finished for life. Tony Fitzpatrick, who had been watching, steps forward. Boss, give him another chance. I'll make sure he behaves. Talk to me tomorrow morning, I barked. This is not the right time. I enter the hall to join Cathy, triumphant. We won the Clydebank game, 3-1, and Frank scored 2. With young people, you have to try to impart a sense of responsibility. If they can add greater awareness to their energy and their talents, they can be rewarded with great careers. One asset I possessed when I started as manager was that I could make a decision. I was never afraid of that, even as a schoolboy picking a team. I was instructing players even then. You play here, and you play there, I used to tell them. Willie Cunningham, one of my early managers, would say, You know, you're a bloody nuisance. I would talk tactics at him and ask, Are you sure you know what you're doing? Nuisance? That's what you are, he would answer.
The other players would sit there listening to my interventions and assume that I was about to be killed for insubordination. But it was just that I could always make a decision. I don't know where it comes from, but I know that as a boy I was an organiser, an instructor, a picker of teams. My father was an ordinary working man, very intelligent, but not a leader of any description, so I was not copying a parental example. On the other hand, there is a part of me I know that is solitary, cut off. At 15, playing for Glasgow schoolboys, I came home after scoring against Edinburgh schoolboys the greatest day of my life, to be told by my father that a big club wanted to talk to me. My response surprised us both. I just want to go out. I want to go to the pictures. What's the matter with you? He said. I wanted to separate myself. I don't know why. To this day, I don't know why I did that. I had to be on my own. My father had been so proud and delighted, and my mother was dancing, saying, "Oh, it's so great, son." My gran was going off her head. Scoring against Edinburgh schoolboys was a big deal. Yet, I had to escape into my own wee vacuum, you know. From there to here is such a vast distance. When I started at Manchester United in 1986, Willie McFall was the manager of Newcastle United. Manchester City had Jimmy Frizzell, and George Graham was in charge at Arsenal. I liked George. Good man. Great friend. When I was having problems with Martin Edwards over my contract, Sir Roland Smith was the chairman of the PLC. The PLC could cause complications at times. You would have to wait for issues to be addressed. One day Sir Roland suggested that Martin, Morris Watkins, the club's solicitor, and I should go over to the Isle of Man to sort out my new deal. George was on double my salary at Arsenal. "I'll give you my contract if you like," George said. "You sure you don't mind?" I said. So over to the Isle of Man I went, with George's contract. Martin was a good chairman for me. He was strong. The problem was, he thought every penny was his. He paid you what he wanted to pay you. Not just me, everyone. When I showed him George's contract, he wouldn't believe it. "Phone David Dean," I suggested. So he did, and David Dean, the Arsenal chairman, denied that George was being paid the sum on the contract. It was a farce. George had given me his documentation, signed by David Dean. Had it not been for Morris and Roland Smith, I would have left the job that day. I was close to leaving anyway. There was a moral there, as in all of my 39 years in the front line. You have to stand up for yourself. There is no other way. 3. Retirement U-turn. On the sofa, that night of Christmas Day 2001, I had nodded off while watching television. In the kitchen, a mutiny was brewing. The traditional assembly room of our family home was the scene for a discussion that would change each of our lives. The chief rebel came in and kicked my foot to wake me. In the frame of the door, I could pick out three figures. All my sons lined up for maximum solidarity. "We've just had a meeting," Kathy said. "We've decided. You're not retiring." As I weighed this announcement, I felt no urge to resist. "One, your health is good. 2, I'm not having you in the house. And 3, you're too young anyway." Kathy did all the early talking, but her sons were right behind her. The gang was united. "You're being stupid, Dad," the boys told me. "Don't do it. You've got a lot to offer. You can build a new team at Manchester United." That'll teach me to nod off for 5 minutes. It ended up with me working for 11 more years. One of the reasons I had decided to stand down in the first place was in reaction to a remark Martin Edwards had made after the 1999 European Cup final in Barcelona. Martin had been asked whether there would be a role for me after I surrendered the manager's job and had replied, "Well, we don't want a Matt Busby situation." I wasn't impressed by that answer. The two periods could not be compared. In my era, you needed to factor in the added complications brought on by agents, contracts, the mass media. No sensible person would want to be embroiled in those activities once he had finished serving his time as manager. There was not the slimmest chance I would want to be involved in the games themselves or the complexities of the football trade. What else made me intend to retire in the first place?
There was always a sense after that magical night in Barcelona that I had reached the pinnacle. Previously, my teams had fallen short in the European Cup, and I had always chased that end